Today on Not Sam Wrestling, former backstage brain and current wrestling brain, Mike Mansouri joins me to talk about WrestleMania Backlash, as well as some of the names that could pop up in NXT at some point, New Jack, and a whole lot more. This is Not Sam Wrestling.
This is Not Sam Wrestling.
Introducing your host from New York, here is Sam Roberts.
Happy Monday. Hello. Welcome to Not Sam Wrestling, fresh off of WrestleMania Backlash. Prepare for the WrestleMania Backlash, because that's what today is going to be all about, as well as other things that have been happening in the wrestling world. Shout out to everybody on Patreon, patreon.com/NotSamWrestling, the superstars and the Hall of Famers that were able to join me in a Zoom room before WrestleMania Backlash. Some of what we said might happen happened. A lot of what we said might happen did not happen. But that is the joy of watching WWE on pay-per-view. I'll tell you what, nobody predicted this fact that, well, the thing that's got me a little scared right now. I'm sitting in my podcast studio wondering, is today the day? Is today the day that the zombies attack? Ah! I gotta get someplace safe. This is terrifying. I'll talk about the zombies. I know, you're sitting there going, Sam, you're the only one that has the, I was going to say balls, but let's be honest, audacity to do it. Can you spin the zombies as lumberjacks into something positive? Well, I'm going to pick Mike Mansouri's brain about that and a whole lot more. Why wait? Let's talk about everything that's happening in the world of wrestling with the man who at one point was a big producer backstage with WWE. He was with us for the WrestleMania Night 1 post-show. He also did the podcast a few weeks before that. For the third time on Not Sam Wrestling, we're going to break this whole thing down with Mike Mansouri.
The Not Sam Wrestling Interview.
Back for WrestleMania Backlash. A man who made quite an impression, I believe, specifically here on Not Sam Wrestling, after night one of WrestleMania. He's been on the podcast a couple of times before. You know him as not only an expert wrestling analysis machine, but somebody who has seen the machine, somebody who has been intimate with the machine, somebody who was the machine. He was one of the top-ranking producers in WWE, a huge part of the backstage of everything that we saw for several years, and now has ventured off into other lands, but today he ventures right here. Michael Mansouri is back on Not Sam Wrestling. Mike, how are we doing?
Sam, we're doing well, babe. Thanks for having me back on, man. I'm looking forward to dissecting the backlash towards WrestleMania Backlash, of which there was a ton.
A ton. There's a ton to get to. Now, before we get to it, though, I know that you're one of the reasons why I think we get along so much is outside of your professional experience in wrestling, you're like wrestling obsessed the same way I am. You started watching wrestling when you were a kid and everything, and you're from the East Coast. So, New Jack. We lost New Jack. I think that it was a tough one. You know, I feel like there are those that, and Nick Gage, you know, they did the Dark Side of the Ring on Nick Gage. And I don't know, a lot of people will take the most negative parts of a person's personal life and try to go, hey, let's not celebrate this. But I think as wrestling fans, especially with somebody like New Jack, what we're doing is reflecting on what New Jack as a character and a performer meant to us. And on that level, you know, when you talk about the icons of ECW, I put New Jack up there as easily top five.
You have to. I mean, New Jack is synonymous with the original incarnation of ECW, the only ECW that should have ever existed in my heart and mind. And I'm sure a lot of wrestling fans feel that way.
Yeah.
I mean, the moment that you heard Natural Born Killers by Dr. Dre and Ice Cube blare through the speakers of the ECW arena, you knew you were going to see some shit. And whether it be Jack coming out with a shopping cart just full of everything from a Nintendo to a staple gun, a crutch, or whether it be a garbage can, you know, you knew you were going to see some really cool shit and some entertaining stuff because Jack was entertaining, you know? But to your point about what you said, Sam, right? Like, I watched the Nick Gage documentary, The Dark Side of the Ring. And look, life is not without its shortcomings for all of us. Everyone has their own personal demons and issues they battle. And I think what I appreciated of that Dark Side is that they didn't sensationalize or look to, you know, condemn the guy for the wrongs that he had committed in life, especially for anybody that's suffering from addiction. That is a beast unlike any other, you know, and they didn't really look to exploit the guy for it. It's just a part of his story. It's a part of who he is, you know, very contrary to the A&E documentary that was done on our guy, the Macho Man Randy Savage, which was a total smear campaign. You know, and look, New Jack again was a guy that a lot of folks you saw in the tributes that a lot of the talent were posting. You know, New Jack had his issues in life, he had his demons, but the character is somebody that we celebrate. We celebrate the character New Jack.
Yeah.
Despite what Jerome Young may have done.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting because, like, with Nick Gage, for me, the headline with Nick Gage is actually what Mox said in that Dark Side of the Ring, the connection that he has with the audience, and that Vince McMahon would kill to have one person that has the connection that Nick Gage has with the audience, that the minute that Nick Gage's music hits, the minute he's announced to come to the ring, it's like, this is my guy. I'm transfixed on everything he's doing. I'll follow him into the grave. Like, MDK being a gang, you feel like you're really part of that gang. And I think that New Jack had that same thing. Like you said, the minute that, like, woo, like, it was really nice that song had that sound effect intro, because the minute that sound effect hit, it was like, this is my thing. And New Jack, he never had an Iron Man match, and this is where Paul Heyman was such a genius with New Jack, too. No Iron Man matches, no ECW championship reigns where he's got to now have this main event and he's got to show his skill. It's like, no, we want to spend the next 7 to 10 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes even, seeing what's in that big Rubbermaid garbage can and watching you hit someone with it over and over again. And New Jack connected in that way. I mean, think about it. With everybody that made Guitar Shots famous, Honky Tonk Man, Jeff Jarrett, Elias, everyone, is there anybody better than New Jack pulling the guitar out of the garbage can, pretending to play on it, and then smashing it?
Wow.
Oh,
no.
Brilliant.
Nothing better. And yeah, you said it right. Paulie was an absolute genius at ECW in terms of projecting and booking his guys, playing to their strengths, as opposed to just putting everybody out there for the sake of a wrestling show. What you were great at, you highlighted. What you were not so great at, we kind of hid. But the funny thing about New Jack, Sam, that a lot of folks tend to overlook is that he actually wasn't a terrible worker.
Right.
The entertainment value obviously was in the over-the-top, extreme, forgive the use of the word, level of violence. That's what got over with New Jack. But New Jack could actually go, man. Like, you know, when the gangsters were getting into those matches with Saturn and Cronus as the Eliminators, like, New Jack showed you he had some fucking chops, outside the fact that he's also an incredible promo. I don't know if you got a chance to see it over Twitter. Like, you know, obviously once the news broke that Jack had passed, a lot of awesome, like, old school Jack promos from way back in Smoky Mountain had started to surface. And the guy just knew how to just hit that button, to get the reaction, the big red button that you don't push, regardless of whatever the social circumstances were. Jack knew when to get it and really how to raise the ire of a crowd. He was a master.
Yeah. Yeah. And he made you believe. He was fearless. Like, he was never afraid of the heat, quote unquote, or whatever would happen. He was fearless, and he was going to deliver that character. I remember in 2013, New Jack had what was at that time his retirement match at PWS. And I was there, and I was doing commentary for them at that time. And his match was, like, right after intermission. So it was intermission, and I was backstage. And New Jack had this bundle of light tubes. And he said, "Hey, come here." And when New Jack says, "Hey, come here," it's like, all right, I'm going to come here, but I don't know. I don't know if this is a great idea. And he said, "All right, we're going to cover these light tubes with a towel. And then I want you to sneak them out with nobody looking at you. I want you to hide them under the ring in the top right corner. I was like, you got it. And he was like, what corner? I was like, the top right corner. He was like, don't fuck it up. I was like, okay, all right. And so I went out and I hit him and everything. And I swear, because with New Jack too, you're like, will he remember? I know that I put them in what I perceive to be the top right corner. Number one, will New Jack?
Was it his top right? My top right? Was it top right?
Top right? Was it stage right or right right? Or and then also in the middle of the match, will New Jack even remember that he told me top right and go like, I told that motherfucker top left? And so I'm sitting there commentating once the match starts and he gets outside the ring and I'm going, oh, please, God. Oh, please, God. Please let them be in the right corner. And thank God he was able to get them out of the right corner and I was able to continue my job. Because that's the other thing. If they were in the wrong corner, like I was at ringside.
Yeah,
so he would have looked up and I had my big hair at the time. He wouldn't have forgotten me. I would have been in a lot of trouble.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. You would. Where's the Q-tip looking motherfucker at? He fucked up my light tube spot.
Yeah.
I only ever had one experience with him, and it was before I got in involved in working in the business. I was a teenager, and I went to ECW's Massacre on 34th Street pay-per-view at the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York.
You and I both.
I think that was the second to last pay-per-view. And I remember after the show, had my little program that came with the price of admission. It was like a school newspaper. It was just like Xerox paper that was stapled up together. And I got to meet like Steve Corino and a couple of the other guys, but I got to meet New Jack. I remember being absolutely terrified.
Yes.
To ask him for an autograph, but mustered up the balls enough to do it. And he couldn't have been any nicer and any cooler.
But that's what was great about New Jack, that you were too old to be at the point that you were terrified of like heel wrestling characters.
Yeah, I think it was like 16 or 17. Right. And here I am. I'm like, excuse me, Mr. New Jack, sir.
Yeah.
I think I may have actually uttered those exact words.
Mr. New Jack, sir.
Mr. New Jack, sir. Could you sign my program, please?
Yeah. Yeah, just the best. So rest in peace to New Jack. And you liked the Nick Gage Dark Side documentary?
I did. It told the guy's story without overlooking the shortcomings, without overlooking the demons. I mean, I never knew about the death match where he had the halogen light tube basically just sever an artery on his arm and he's just bleeding out, but was crazy enough to want to go back out. Look, you've got to be a very, very committed individual to want to continue to do that and very passionate about the business, which Nick is. But I know a lot of folks look at those dark sides as that they can be trashy and, you know, sensationalistic and look to exploit, again, the dark side of the wrestling business to make a buck. But I actually thought that the Nick Gage documentary was actually very tastefully done.
Yeah. Yeah. And how great was it when he's yelling at the cameraman? He's like, make sure you get that on camera, that I want to get back in the ring.
You fucking Mark, get that on camera.
Do you think that there is, in your experience, you know, to me, the wrestling world is like changing in such a dramatic way. And, you know, I feel like AEW has changed wrestling, but I think the internet has changed wrestling. I think that, you know, there was a time when Kevin Steen was a guy who was not a WWE type. You're never going to make it in WWE. Samoa Joe never is going to be in WWE, let alone main eventing pay-per-views. You know, Eddie Kingston was an East Coast indie guy. He's just not a guy who's going to be on a national platform, right? I think wrestling has changed. And I would like to think that we're all beyond that point, especially with the popularity that people are building. Even outside of being on national platforms, they're creating their own national platforms through social media and pro wrestling tees and getting word out and stuff. Do you think there is a play where an organization like the WWE, be it on Raw, SmackDown, or NXT, could bring in somebody like Nick Gage, who specializes, and obviously you're not going to get light tube, artery severing, barbed wire, you know, brutality Nick Gage, but I don't think that's the only thing that Nick Gage brings to the table. Do you, and I don't think that you need that to connect the way Nick Gage connects. Do you think there is a version of that that could work within the WWE landscape?
I think so. Right. I think so. I mean, if you go back 20 some odd years, right, who'd have thought that Cactus Jack would have worked in the WWF?
Great point.
And when Cactus emerged after years of Mick Foley portraying Mankind, and then you see this even more sadistic side of him that came out during this feud with Triple H, you're like, all right, cool, this guy could have a home here. And it was not so, you know, it was a little blend of the WCW version of Cactus Jack and a lot of Mick's history at FMW with the deathmatch tournaments over there. So it was a nice little meld in bringing that in there. And I thought it worked. And I think it can work now. I think what's interesting, Sam, right, to your point, we live in an era, where anyone can be a content creator, and anyone pretty much is a content creator. And you really find yourself in a position where you can have folks from all walks of life really leave a hell of a mark, and, you know, they can have a presence in any field in which they choose. I mean, look at the Paul brothers.
Sure.
These are two young brothers. And look, great athletic credentials. They're both standout wrestlers back in Ohio, where, you know, tough wrestlers are bred. And they started out just making videos on YouTube and making content and Vine videos and stuff like that. And now they're boxing people in front of millions on pay-per-view and thousands in attendance. I mean, what Logan Paul's got Floyd Mayweather in a couple of weeks in Miami at Hard Rock Stadium. Like, that's pretty wild. That situation 25 years ago would have never existed. You would never have found Floyd Mayweather, who at the time was considered one of the best boxers in the world, boxing a kid, you know, from YouTube. Wouldn't happen. The world is a different place, and I don't see, you know, the wrestling landscape being anything excluded from that. I think if anything, that's a side of the world that should be embraced a lot more. Though I wouldn't expect to find like the next megastar, your next Hulk Hogan or John Cena out of that lot, but you will find somebody that folks will attach themselves to, because I think that's kind of what it is right now with all these content creators, right? It's basically, who can I associate with that's the most like me?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? But on a much more relatable level than that superstar level of all the wrestlers / celebrities that we grew up with as kids.
It's that close connection. It's that hitting people almost on an individual level, one by one by one by one, instead of just getting the masses. And I mean, you know, I think that when you look at like Matt Riddle, for example, who I know that you agree with me when I say like that dude is a future WWE champion, he should already be on the road if he's not already. I mean, it should be Randy Orton, and then the next stop is Bobby Lashley. He's ready to be the guy. But it wasn't that long ago that people were saying, well, he will never be in WWE, not because of his look, not because of his athleticism, but because he's so public about his recreational hobbies. And now we've gotten to this place where his recreational hobbies, I mean, there's literally pigeons shooting out of his feet that are CGI. Like, his recreational hobbies are his gimmick. They haven't really changed Riddle in the WWE version. And I mean, like, I remember Riddle showing up in NXT and sitting in the front row of that takeover and people being like, oh my God, Matt Riddle's here. Can you imagine? Fans are back in buildings. NXT is back in Brooklyn. It's the Barclays. It's the East Coast. And they flash to the front row, and Nick effing Gage is in the front row of a takeover. I mean, you want to do something that just sends shockwaves through everything? I don't care if you sign him for a 3-month run in NXT and that's it. Do you understand the reaction you would get? Especially
huge.
After this dark side has kind of opened a lot of eyes to who this guy is. If Nick Gage is sitting in the front row of a takeover and he's got the bandana on, he doesn't look any different. He's Nick Gage, MDK Nick Gage. I don't know if you're really going to say MDK. That's probably pushing it. But Nick effing Gage is right there. And he's just, you know, maybe he spends next summer tearing through NXT. Maybe, you know, a season. Doesn't have to be years and years and years. You don't have to sit there and go, wow, you're not going to do that because what's he going to do? Go to Raw and then go to SmackDown? It's like, no. Just for a run. Just a quick run like the old territory days. Send some shockwaves, and then we'll assess after. That's not to say he wouldn't be a long-term guy, but do a fun 3 months, reassess.
You know, it's funny that you bring that up. I was thinking about that very recently, the concept of the old territory system and how somebody would come in,
they'd work
the territory for 3, 6, 9 months and then on to the next. And, you know, you learned, you got over, or for the more established guys, you just came in, you had a good run, you drew some money and you elevated some talent. And, you know, now like Impact having this working relationship with AEW and, you know, MLW's becoming a player with their TV deal with Vice. And, you know, there's people talking about WWE and MLW doing business down the line. I think it's great. And especially now, Sam, right? Like to kind of, again, tie it all into what we were talking about in terms of just people's taste now and where they are with how they consume content. Who really is keeping up with the week to week, the day to day of anything anymore? You know, and if you could get a little flash hit, because here's the thing, you signed Nick Gage to a year contract with WWE, let's say, after 3 months, he's pretty much going to become stale.
Right.
Why not do these little short tested runs and bring somebody in,
man,
and have a good time? And here's the thing is that, like, you're almost kind of, in a way, powering up the generator very hard on indie wrestling.
Yeah.
Because all you're doing now is you're elevating the standings of these guys that would get that little TV run with these programs. I'm all for it. I think it'd be awesome. I don't know if it would work at NXT, because NXT doesn't necessarily I don't know if Nick Gage is going to fit the bill there, but you know, I could be wrong.
Yeah, man. I mean, I think that 3 to 6 month contract should be the regular thing in wrestling in general. Not because I don't want the boys to work, because I want the boys to work more. I want the idea of, you know, MJF is getting over in AEW, and who knows, by Survivor Series, he could be in WWE. And then if he shows up at Survivor Series, maybe he'll go to WrestleMania and then show back up in AEW. And then Sammy Guevara is over on SmackDown, and then Drew McIntyre is on Impact. And, like, you know, I think in this day and age, mobility would actually make things better for everybody. Like, I mean, I had Danhausen. You know who Danhausen is? Are you familiar with Danhausen?
So I wasn't until seeing him on your show and on Renee Young's Oral Sessions podcast.
Yeah. Like, I mean,
what an interesting cat.
How great would it be? Because Danhausen, right? With the paint and everything, calls himself Danhausen. Don't Housen Dan him. Don't try to change his name so you can own it. Like, just Danhausen. And he's sitting there in the front row of a takeover. And you're like, what the hell is happening? I mean, just what you just said, right? You just go, I don't know that Nick Gage would work in NXT, because it's not really what NXT does. But it's like, you need people to show up, that even us, like the smartest watchers, are sitting there going, like, whoa, like, what is going on? That's not what NXT does.
You got to shake shit up.
And they're here. Yeah, let's shake things up again. You know, I think it'd be amazing.
I think it would be, too. And I think also, Sam, for the younger talent, right? You know, I used to hear a lot of the older talent, especially the older wrestlers that had been part of the territory system, whether it be, like, at the heart of it or the last remnants of it. You really do miss on that opportunity to go different places and to try new things and to really get an understanding of what's over and how to work a crowd and really understand how to work a different audience, because you're not in front of the same people every week. You know, like, without being disparaging, like, a lot of wrestling becomes homogenized, especially the wrestlers themselves, when they're just in one place doing what works and doing what they know, because it's all they know, and it's you know, how they were brought up or whatever the case may be. You're missing that opportunity to really go out and to explore and to really try new things.
Yeah, I agree. That's why a guy like Finn Balor, for example, can kind of just really do these minor tweaks to what he does in the ring to show off an entirely new character, you know, to have this character on NXT and then tweak it a little bit so it fits a little bit better on Raw and SmackDown, and then tweak it just a little bit again so that when he shows up on NXT, he's like this completely new entity. But that's because he had so much experience before coming to WWE, performing in front of every conceivable type of audience against every conceivable type of opponent.
Yeah, I mean, look at look at, you know, look at a guy like Jericho, right? Jericho, at the beginning of his career, Mexico, Japan, everywhere in between, ECW, Canada, you know, until finally making a name for himself in WCW and then eventually catapulting on to WWE. Like, it's, you know, just hearing stories, like JBL used to tell stories all the time about working for Otto Bontz in Austria and Germany, and just like what that experience kind of left him with before he came back to the States. Like, you know, there's something to be said for getting that, you know, that seasoning. You know what I mean? It's just like any kid that wants to study abroad to really broaden their horizons when they're in college, you know, to get yourself some outside life experience. I think it's worth it. You know, I think it's worthwhile. I mean, you know, look, it's awesome to have something like the Performance Center in NXT, where it's basically wrestling university, right? Like you're getting a course in wrestling from probably a top notch sort of faculty, very Harvard-esque sort of wrestling faculty, right? And you're getting paid to do it. So it's a pretty cool system, a pretty cool opportunity. But again, it's very homogenized in that you're in the same controlled environment with no variable. You know what I mean? Like you need that outside influence, you need that outside experience. It'll just help in the growth and really just bringing new shit into the product. Because like you said, think of how cool it is when you see somebody from the outside come in to show that you love, and you're like, oh my God, this is gonna be so great, but then it's gone.
Yeah, yeah. And JBL
becomes watered down.
Yeah, absolutely. And JBL is such a good example, because JBL is one of these guys that it's like he comes in and they're like, we need you to be a cowboy. He's like, All right, now we need you to be a blackjack. Oh, okay. All right, now we need you to be like a Satan worshiping bodyguard. Okay. All right, now we just need you to be a beer drinking guy who hangs out with Ron Simmons. Got it. Okay, now we need you to be a stockbroker. Okay, no problem. And it's like boom, 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 because he knows, because you know, he's had that experience. All right. Let's backlash now. Let's talk about backlash. We're just coming off WrestleMania Backlash. First of all, big announcement. Hell in a Cell is back already. Hell in a Cell is in June. Usually the spot that I think Money in the Bank is in.
Mm-hmm.
We had a Hell in a Cell in October. This year's Hell in a Cell is now taking place in June. So
just in time for Father's Day.
Yeah. Are we thinking Drew versus Bobby? And I mean, it seems like Seth versus Cesaro is going to be in a Hell in a Cell, right?
I think it would have to be.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so I've always had a very large gripe with the pay-per-views that are based off of a gimmick match or a match with a stipulation such as a Hell in a Cell. If you go back to the original Hell in a Cell at Bad Blood with The Undertaker and Shawn Michaels, their story warranted the introduction of the Cell. And over the last couple of years, since Hell in a Cell became its own pay-per-view, basically you knew where whatever hot story had been coming in after SummerSlam was going to culminate in a Hell in a Cell match. There wasn't that element of surprise of, oh shit, they're breaking out Hell in a Cell. They worked themselves to Hell in a Cell. It was just all right, well, I can kind of understand how the next couple months of booking are going to go, because Hell in a Cell is coming up in October and it's going to be these two in that match. And for SmackDown, we'll have these two in that match. And maybe we'll, you know, it sounds like they want to do something for the women, so it'll be these two in that match. You know, it became predictable, and almost you took away the importance and you lessened the impact of actually having Hell in a Cell.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there was a time when it was like, and we're going to do it in hell, in a cell. Oh my God. No. Oh my God. But now it's like, and we're going to do it, I guess, in Hell in a Cell. It's September, right? Yeah, in Hell in a Cell. Hell in a Cell. Yeah, I know. It's October.
You know where we're going.
Yeah. That's when Hell in a Cell is. Or it's just like, you know, and it's going to be so-and-so versus so-and-so in a Hell in a Cell. And you're like, I mean, okay. Like, it's not warranted, but I'll watch it. You know, it'll be good. I get that.
Yeah, I was never big on that. Like, you know, Elimination Chamber, when it kind of became the alternative to find out who the, you know, whoever won the Royal Rumble, once they made their challenge known for WrestleMania, is like, all right, well, we'll find out who the other title challenger will be after Elimination Chamber. But again, when the chamber was introduced, it was kind of this cool concept, and it would get broken out, you know, every once in a while. Then again, it became its own gimmick pay-per-view. So you just kind of made everything very formulaic. And as opposed to looking forward to it, you were, you know, me personally and friends that I know that are fans of the business, it was just kind of like, all right, let's just get through it so we can get to what the story's going to be on the other side.
Like you expect it. It becomes an expectation instead of something you're like, whoa, no, it's built up to this much. It's like, we're past the point of no return. Like now we're like, no, there's 3 Hell in a Cell matches on this pay-per-view. You're like,
yeah, because like right growing up for us, and I think still to some extent in the business, right, big gimmick matches like that were always the blow off, right? They were always culmination of the big stories, you know. But instead now they just become another step to get you to where you're going to go next.
Although I do love when people are like, oh, Hell in a Cell matches don't mean anything anymore because now you like people leave them all the time. So it doesn't matter. And I'm like, you mean like the first one that they ever did? Like every Hell in a Cell match has ever been? When are you talking about? At what point in Hell in a Cell's history was it able to keep the combatants locked in? Or was it able to compete? I mean, was it able to keep interference from becoming part of the match? It's literally never happened.
No. And like you said, from match number one.
One.
From the first Hell in a Cell, Shawn and Taker got out.
Yeah.
Went to the top. Yeah. Shawn fell off. Kane broke into the cell to make his debut in that first match. Like,
right. That's like, so you're sitting here going like, yeah, just so you know, interference and chicanery outside the cell can happen. Yeah. And historically does. Yeah. No, absolutely. Do you have a match of the night?
I mean, you'd be very hard pressed to find anybody that wouldn't call Cesaro Roman Reigns for the Universal Championship match of the night. Man.
Yeah.
Man, what a fight. Just Roman Reigns once again showing why he's in the position he's in and why there's probably nobody better in the business right now. And Cesaro highlighting for everyone in the world to see that he has deserved for a very long time to be in a main event picture, not just some floundering character that they don't know what to do with.
Yeah, I thought it was really great. I thought that the way they told the story of the match, it was almost this story that you've seen play out a million times before, but for some reason felt different this time. And I think that's just because Roman is so good and Cesaro is so good as well, that like, you know, the story is that Roman resents even being in the ring with Cesaro. Roman does not consider Cesaro on his level. And the first half of the match is Roman proving that Cesaro is not on his level. And we build and we build and find, and we work a body part. We work a body part. It's the right arm. And finally we get to this comeback. And all of a sudden Roman Reigns, it's all over his face. He's like, what? How is he surviving? How is he still here? And all that. And then finally Roman Reigns does win at the end of the night. So it's like Roman Reigns is still the champion. Roman Reigns is the head of the table. Roman Reigns is the man. But the idea that Cesaro didn't belong in the ring with Roman, that is what Cesaro has disproved. And we've seen that story play out so many times in wrestling. But I just feel like Roman is just playing at a different level than we've seen.
Yeah, he's operating on just the on a very, very like seldom occupied plane in the business.
Yeah.
That only few have ever dared to stay there consistently, right?
Yeah.
What I loved about the match and the story of the match was, you know, right, all the smart fans know that in America you work the left side of the body, right?
Uh-huh.
Everyone the left side of the body is where you always work. So you almost, they tried to add like an element of let's swerve everybody, right, by Cesaro injuring the right arm and that fall out of the ring. And then you realize that all of Cesaro's stuff, especially his most notable weapon, the European uppercuts, always generated from the right arm, and he seems to be a right arm dominant guy. So you know, you pull a fast one on people. You tell a good story. I mean, he had some pretty good abrasions on that arm right by his bicep.
Yeah.
And they just did some awesome work, man. Like Roman shit talking Cesaro, and Cesaro's just, you know, these crazy feats of strength that he pulls out. Like, you know, I love that deadlift superplex that he always does, where he just takes you from the ground and all the way up and down. You know, the power bomb out of catching Roman. And so just awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Awesome.
Just Roman sitting there going like, this is fun for me. You having a good time?
Yeah.
You having a good time? And it's like,
I think I think Roman at one point said, "You don't think this shit's fun for me?" Yeah, here we go.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was great. I was surprised. First, okay, a couple of things. The Seth Rollins appearance at the end, I liked it.
Watercolor jacket.
Oh, I mean, look. Wherever Seth Rollins is getting his suits from, please introduce me to your tailor because it's just this version of Seth Rollins and what he's wearing is doing a great job. Seth is still extremely underrated. For as much as he's gotten, I still find Seth Rollins to be underrated. But on one end, I was surprised to see them close a pay-per-view on a Seth Rollins Cesaro angle that, you know, by traditional logic is like, oh, it's like a mid-card angle, right? And I guess, you know, there's not a title on the line, but, you know, we're playing by different sets of rules sometimes. And I think that that's a good thing. So I was surprised by and liked that they closed on that angle. I liked that there were multiple stories going on at the same time. I always loved that. I think storytelling is the number one thing that should be paid attention to in wrestling. And I feel like that happens more on SmackDown than any other show. So I liked that there were multiple stories with Roman being, you know, having the lay put on him and the whole thing. But man, when Rollins and Roman were staring each other down, and I think this was completely by design, and I think we'll get there. But like, I'm sitting there and I'm like, there it is. Like that we have, I, in my head, I'm like fast forwarding through months of stories. And I'm like, I have found the spot where Seth Rollins is able to accomplish what I think WWE wanted from Seth Rollins at WrestleMania 35 after beating Brock Lesnar. And that sort of top good guy run that, in my opinion, did not work. And one of the reasons it didn't work is because he was being booked as Becky Lynch's boyfriend. And the whole, I mean, there were a lot of missteps in that Seth Rollins, timing was off. You know, people were wanting that when Seth Rollins first came back from his injury. So there was a lot working against Seth there. And I think Seth is really, and I hope he feels okay about it. I think that he's in a very good spot to, at this moment, not be in the main event. And to let it simmer, let us want that to happen again. But I mean, man, if Seth Rollins as a top good guy versus Roman Reigns as a top bad guy is not a huge money series of matches, I don't know what is.
I'll tell you what, I'll even take this iteration of Seth with this iteration of Roman, and you can still make a lot of money with them.
Yeah, I agree.
You don't even need to turn Seth babyface for it to have it go, because I feel like this works. I feel like this leans itself more to Seth, just like this leans itself more to who Roman really is. And I agree. I love the stare down between the two of them that led into the beatdown. It's just good. And I liked the fact that it's funny, right? Like, and a lot of times with storylines, and I used to always wonder this on the inside, and that when I was in WWE and asked questions about all the time, why can't you ever just cross? Why can't you have any sort of intersection of stories, or why can't something meld into something else but then come out of it? And you got a little bit of that tonight.
Yeah.
In a very, very cool way. Really interested to see what's going to happen between Jimmy and Jey Uso.
Yeah.
Love that you got a cliffhanger, right? That, because, you know, if you think back to the Attitude Era and what everyone loved was that at the end of every show, you were always left with something to get you to next week. And now if you're a SmackDown fan, you got a little bit of a taste. And even if it's something that folks might consider a quote unquote mid-card story, even though it's not, these guys are top tier.
Right.
You got left with a pretty cool cliffhanger at the end of this to kind of entice you to tune in on Friday. And I love it. I'd love to see more of this. I hope they start to do more of this because it really is missing. It almost seems like a lot of times most of the shows tend to culminate with just a very ending. And not so much leaving you with a, wow, I got to see what happens next week more so. Well, I can't believe I just sat through that.
Yeah. And I think you're right about Seth. I think Seth is so good at what he's doing now. And on some level, like with villains, when you get really good at portraying a villain and people believe it, you know, even though it's just a character, like people just, they buy into the character and they enjoy the character and they believe your interpretation of the character. you normally just have to tweak it a little bit. Like there are these tiny little things that Seth Rollins could do while maintaining everything else that he's doing, maintaining his ego, maintaining his kind of weaselness, but just little things that he could do that I think would lead the audience to cheering him in a program with Roman Reigns, which I think is the ideal thing, right? Because Roman is so good at what he's doing. I kind of worry that when live audiences come back, they'll start cheering him.
They could. They very well could. Yeah. And, you know, I am kind of curious to see how that presentation, not that it changes, but what the reception is going to be. What's the reception of Roman Reigns going to be with the crowd? Because, look, everyone loves, eventually all your heels will get cheered.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Regardless, in spite of your best efforts, more often than not, all of your heels will wind up getting cheered at some point. And, you know, I like the concept of breaking against the traditional good guy versus bad guy thing. And I think you have such unique characters in Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins that you really can try and build a very viable and, you know, interesting and compelling story with these two characters. And, if anything, I think it'd be a great challenge for Roman in that I think Seth has only really started to scratch the surface on this new character, this new Seth Rollins character. And I think given a little bit more, just because of how great of a performer Seth is in and out of the ring, that it'll only challenge Roman to be that much better with what he does. And what's so great about Roman is that his heat, outside of being generated from the ring, his heat is also generated a lot in the storyline that he has with his cousins and with Paul Heyman. You know, that I love that multi-dimensional facet to the Roman Reigns character, and that you like, okay, I may find what he does in the ring to be really cool and the shit talking and all that stuff. And then just the way he relates to these guys that are supposed to be his family by holding basically their livelihoods and his family stature over everyone's head and putting it on his back. You just want to see, you're like, this smarmy motherfucker. You know what I mean? It's such a great tool that Roman has to just continue to build heat. And, you know, look, I'm sure everyone down the line is salivating at the mouth, over the head of the table, maybe one day coming face to face with the guy who a lot of folks do see as the head of the table for the NOI family, The Rock. And, you know, it gives you an interesting place to go with a lot of this shit.
There was a moment where I was wishing that somebody on commentary would have referenced Bret Hart locking Yokozuna in the sharpshooter. Yoko being a member of the Anoa'i family and the sharpshooter being the thing, WrestleMania 10, I would have gone there. That's all I'm saying. I would have gone there, but I'm a Yoko fan from back in the day. What did you think, speaking of commentary, there were multiple references to Daniel Bryan in this match. And while it fit 100%, Daniel Bryan was retired in real life and in story, depending on what you're reading, but everything that you read says that Brian's contract legit expired on the day of SmackDown that he lost the career match. What do you see? I think it's very interesting. I talked about it on the podcast how Brian is. He's just so. I don't even think people get how smart Brian is. That Brian will do these like interviews that it seems like he's doing a shoot interview. It seems like he's like, you know, the way he talks about, oh, WrestleMania didn't feel the same for me this year, or, oh, I'd like to wrestle for other promotions, or, oh, yeah, no, I think my career's winding down. But he never mentioned that his contract was up. And it's like, huh, wait a minute. Are you just
a troll?
Are you just shooting from the hip, or do you know exactly what you're doing all the time because you're a genius? Oh,
Sam, he is the ultimate troll. He is one of the smartest dudes just within and outside of wrestling. Nothing that came out of his mouth, I can assure you, was done accidentally.
So what do you see? And by the way, if you want any evidence of that, go to the Table for Three with Brian, Ryback, and Dolph Ziggler, because Brian is trolling Ryback and calling him the Ryback.
The Ryback.
The entire time.
I remember when he started doing that backstage. And just seeing the reaction of everybody, it's just good shit, man. He's again, just a very, very brilliant dude, man. A guy who I enjoyed working with a lot, especially when we were doing Talking Smack, right? So when the network is launched, they're just throwing all these shows out, right? So for me, I was assigned the kickoff shows, and I had Raw Talk and Talking Smack. And but those shows were basically given no direction. It was just make of this what you will. And we always just tried to see how we can push the envelope and how we can kind of pull the curtain back a little bit, but also give an opportunity to, you know, showcase the talent, give talent an opportunity to really let a side of themselves out that they don't get the opportunity to do so on TV that much more, and even get the reps in cutting a promo. I mean, one of the most famous moments that took place on that show was the Ms. Daniel Bryan square off that went viral. I think we came up with that in 2 minutes.
It's amazing.
Based off of what we had done the week or 2 weeks prior, where we took the show to black while Miz was in the middle of a rant about being left off of SmackDown as Intercontinental Champion. And, you know, I think, God, I can't remember what arena we were in. I could see it in my head. I just can't remember where. But I remember the four of us, actually, Miz, Renee, Brian, and myself, we all sat down. And in 2 minutes, Brian just kind of let it all out and how it was going to escalate. It was unbelievable. And obviously, you know, it resonated and it connected. And, you know, the interesting part is, Sam, right, again, to tie it back into what we were talking about earlier, right, Brian, in a lot of those interviews that he was doing, was talking about, you know, maybe try to figure out working a deal with WWE where he could still be part of the company, but he could go work elsewhere. Dude, it's interesting. I don't see WWE going for it.
Yeah.
But, you know, hey, you never know. It's 2021. Things are changing and things are different. So you want to keep a guy like Daniel Bryan around, maybe you acquiesce and you allow him to do something like that.
And workers are going to work, huh? Workers are going to work.
Workers are going to work. Workers will always work.
That's what I was saying. I was like, wait. Were you shooting from the hip or were you negotiating? What was going on there? And you're like, oh, right. Workers are going to work. That's that's old brother. I didn't know if Andre was going to let me win the match. Oh, okay. Workers are going to work.
By the time I slammed him, he was 800 pounds and he had grown to 8 feet tall.
By the way, real quick, because you brought up the Daniel Bryan Talking Smack. You know what was great about that? That is a very difficult skill. It's something that I find in myself that I don't have at times that I have needed to be better at, is the fact that Renee shut up. The fact that she didn't talk. The fact that she didn't have to get in there with the, like, oh, guys, this is getting serious. It's like, yeah, it was before you said that. She was perfect. Perfect in the fact that she just let it play out. And I mean, it's tough in that position because I've been in positions like that where you want to kind of assert yourself in your role, but it's not necessary.
No, and I think she understood the gravity of that situation because, again, it did feel so real that her reaction was, you know, pretty genuine. It was going down. Like it was uncomfortable while that was happening.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just a testament to Renee and how strong she is with all that shit and picking up and reading the room. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you look at all that time during Talking Smack, like she was pretty nimble and pretty flexible, and so was Brian, man. I mean, God, do you remember? I think the Usos had been on a couple of times. Like they would give Brian like their hats, and Brian would just go. It's like he would just become like, you know, cool hip Brian.
Yeah, it was such a good show. That's one of those shows that like people should go back and rewatch because it was really, really good. Independently,
we had a blast, man. And I think the problem was is that after that Miz Brian segment, people started catching on to what we were doing. And then all of a sudden we started getting writers assigned to Talking Smack. And that's where everything just kind of went downhill from there. Cause then we're kind of being fed bullet points of what to hit. And this is what we need to do. And we're going to start setting up angles. So,
yeah,
you know, while it was fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the way of the world. I also, think that the WWE Championship triple threat match was pretty great. I was doing watch alongside big man Mark Henry, salt of the earth, while this match was on. And I mean, the speed at which these three were going, and the agility that they showed off was pretty remarkable. I'm talking about Drew, Bobby, and the big Stroman Express, of course.
Choo-choo.
I choo-choo-choose you.
Brother, what a match. What a hard-hitting match. The big men just fucking going at it, doing what they do. I got to tell you, anytime anyone does a spot by the LED boards that Bobby got launched through, I always cringe, because one time I was walking and I had a suit on, but I walked a little too close to the edge, and like they're almost there. If you look closely at them, they're almost like set like tic-tac-toe boards, right? Like they're all just kind of like intersecting lines of LEDs. And one of the corners of the panels got caught in my suit jacket and ripped up my arm to just above my elbow, and left a pretty nice looking gash on there. Bobby had a pretty good open wound on the back of his head, man. So, fuck, these guys are brave for doing that. So I think he got banged up pretty good when they did the spear through the wall years ago with he and Braun. But, man, yeah, just a hard-hitting match. Cool to see these guys doing, like, you know, Drew doing the old high spots here and there. Braun doing his little cannonball and shit, like, I loved it. I loved it. It was a hard hitting match. It's exactly what it needed to be. And I like Bobby getting a chicken shit heel win.
Yeah. Just coming out of nowhere.
As much as
you can in that match. Yeah. I think I said on the watch along, if I'd gotten thrown through an LED board like Bobby Lashley was, I would have been disappeared for 8 to 12 months if you ever saw me again. And Mark Henry responded, Sam, if you got thrown through a shower curtain, you would have disappeared for 8 to 12 months. although I was a little, I would have thought, in my mind, I would have had it go in the reverse. I would have had Bobby get another win over Drew, just to take Drew. I feel like Drew needs to be put in a space where he has to rebuild again. And I feel like, having gotten beat at WrestleMania and in the triple threat match, you know, you can still say, well, there was a distraction at WrestleMania. Triple threat is a triple threat. Even if he's the one that got pinned, he took damage from both Braun and Bobby. Like, there's excuses that can be made, but ultimately it's like, okay, I got to go rebuild, as opposed to, you know, the natural thing here is that Drew didn't get beat, so he can go and have another match with Bobby. But I don't see Drew beating Bobby anytime soon.
No, but to your point, right? Like, you got to, if you didn't beat Drew, my gut tells me that you didn't beat Drew because you're going to go to Drew and Bobby inside Hell in a Cell.
Yeah.
You know, just the Raw representation for that side. But to your point, and it's interesting, right? Like, you know, Drew has the moment last year at WrestleMania, goes over Brock, goes, you know, has a decent title run, loses to Randy, great chase with Randy, becomes champion again, and then drops it, you know. And you eventually get to Bobby as your champion with the whole Money in the Bank thing with Miz, et cetera. It's odd, but yeah, I guess he is in a little bit of a rebuilding phase. And I think it's because the way Bobby has emerged onto the scene since January.
Yeah.
And it's not, I don't think it's a win-loss thing for Drew or him losing any sort of momentum. I think Drew's still a very big character. I think the problem is that Bobby's become that much bigger of a character that you do need to kind of elevate Drew McIntyre now to that level, or whoever is going to challenge Bobby going forward. And that's the thing, is that, you know, in terms of right now on the Raw roster, if you look on that side, right, I think Riddle right now is on the perfect slow build, whatever they're going to wind up doing between he and Randy down the line, which I would imagine, I would hope for Riddle's sake, culminates in him having a couple of matches with Randy. Hopefully by SummerSlam, we'll get that story told. But, you know, who's really ready on the Raw side that you're going to bring forward to challenge Bobby, especially going into a pay-per-view like a Hell in a Cell? You know, at least on the other side of Hell in a Cell, you'll have, 2 months to build to SummerSlam?
Yeah, and I wouldn't be shocked if Braun Strowman just comes out like a train and just charges through the Hell in a Cell wall. Just enters.
Just dust off Goldberg and get him out there.
That's it. Yeah, you're good to go. I thought Bianca versus Bayley was a good match. I feel like Bianca, I think over the last 5 weeks, more could have been done with Bianca, but I feel like it's almost being protected. Like, it's almost like yeah, let's like let's not rush to get everything out of Bianca that we can. But I do feel like Bayley has more to offer right now. I feel like we're looking at peak Bayley. You know, I think coming off of the last year, going into WrestleMania, now into this pay-per-view, I feel like we are looking at Bayley performing at a level that we have not seen her perform at. She keeps getting better and better and better. And I wish that Bayley was utilized to the fullest extent.
I agree. I think tonight Bayley outclassed Bianca. I'm a big Bianca Belair fan.
Yep.
I've been a big fan since the moment I first met her when she walked through the doors of the Performance Center. And I, you know, remember saying to Mark Henry, who found Bianca, that young lady's going to be a massive star. With that said, you know, look, she had a phenomenal showing at WrestleMania, and really much has not been done with her over the last 5 weeks or so since WrestleMania, right? It showed tonight. I don't think that she was on her game tonight. I thought that she had a less than stellar showing, especially being your SmackDown Women's Champion against who the woman that I believe right now is the best female competitor in WWE and probably all of the business in Bayley.
Yeah. 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 And I mean, yeah, and I think you're right. You know, I think that with Bianca, I feel like there are a great many people that you can put her with. I feel like Bianca should go on a tear now, just going through all the women. I think Bianca should be wrestling most weeks on SmackDown, if not every week on SmackDown, just to number one, get the reps in, and number two, show the world what she's capable of. Like, show the world what she does. What does it look like when she's in there with Carmella? What does it look like when she's in there with Nia Jax? Like, what, show all of this. Yeah.
You said something very key there, Sam, in terms of Bianca not getting reps. And this is where not having live events hurts a younger talent like a Bianca Belair. And that, you know, right, traditionally you would see, you know, if you knew that Bianca and Bayley were going to be the match at the pay-per-view, they'd probably work a good 8 to 10 times on the live events before they got to that pay-per-view, just so you could really get a feel for each other and bring along the younger of the two talents. And I that was pretty glaring tonight. I don't think Bianca wasn't ready to be in that position. And at the same token, you know, look, Bayley might have to just work a little bit harder to become, you know, I thought Sasha did a great job at WrestleMania being a phenomenal ring general and really bringing Bianca along in that match. And I think that's something that Bayley might have to kind of lean into a little bit more, you know, but again, that's probably something that she doesn't know from the lack of in-ring time with Bianca and getting the opportunity to get a feel for her and let Bianca get a feel for Bayley.
We got new SmackDown tag team champions, father, son, Dominic and Rey. Interesting way it was done with the, you know, Dominic getting jumped on the pre-show and then coming in kind of mid-match and, you know, and all good. I feel like this has to be leading to Dominic turning on dear old dad. I mean, it's what I want to see.
I thought we were going to get it. I thought we were going to get the Owen turning on Bret at the 94 Royal Rumble.
Oh, yeah. Kicking his leg out of his leg.
Yeah, I thought we were going to get Dominic just fucking slap and pop in the face. I thought we were going to get that tonight. I've never really been too big on this storyline of the Dominic Rey stuff. Like, I thought it was cool when it was woven in with Seth Rollins and you kind of had like that personal feel to it. And now it just seems very much kind of like, well, this is just a meant to appease Rey, and Dominic's not really ready to be in this spot. You know, I felt bad for Bobby Roode having to sell a shitty frog splash to lose the tag title.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. You know, I think that for Dominic's sake, we need to see Dominic without Rey. Like, we need to see, to not have that feeling that you had. I think you need to see Dominic on his own. And I feel like in order to do that, the best way you can get there is have him turn on Rey and then have a series of matches between Dominic and Rey. Like, if Rey Mysterio is going to take care of anybody, is going to show anybody the ropes. Yeah. So hopefully by the end of that rivalry, we'll be left with a Dominic who's kind of like, okay, ready to venture out on his own.
I see that. I see Dominic versus Rey Mysterio in the cards for SummerSlam.
Yeah. Yeah. I do too. I do too. And I hope so. Rhea retained. Charlotte pointed at her as if she was a WrestleMania sign. Was a good opener. You know, all good, right? I mean, I don't.
Yeah, I think what I liked about this triple threat match, Sam, was I think it was just, you know, one of the first that I remember in a very long while where it wasn't a situation where the match was built where it's all right, work, 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 lay somebody out for a couple minutes, the other two will go, that person will reemerge, will knock somebody else out, they'll work for another couple minutes. Like, I liked how all three women were incorporated throughout the match.
Yes.
The finish was a little weird. I didn't understand how Charlotte was incapacitated by hitting Asuka with a big boot from the apron.
Yeah,
to the point where she couldn't break up the pin. Like that to me was a little bit interesting. But, you know, creative liberty or whatever the case may be there. But I like the way they put that together. I really like the way that match is put together. I'm still not a believer in Rhea Ripley.
Whoa.
I get you're making her and she's definitely the future of where you want to go. And it's a little tough when your divisions, I think by having the women split across, you know, let's just say all three WWE shows, Raw, SmackDown, and NXT, you're highlighting how shallow your rosters are on each brand, right? So with that, you're having, you know, you're not, Rhea doesn't have an opportunity to build and get to that title spot. You're basically being built by giving the title and then going,
yep,
you know, and I don't think she's, again, in the position yet to where she's outshone a Charlotte or an Asuka. I'm just not a believer in Rhea Ripley yet. It's a situation kind of like what you saw with Bianca tonight, where sooner or later she will be exposed and it's not going to be good.
So I get what you're saying. And I wanted Charlotte to win and hold the title for a long time. And like have a story of Rhea, I guess the same with Drew that I was saying, like the rebuilding of Rhea Ripley and like the reintroduction and make us on Raw believe in Rhea the way we believed in her in NXT. Because right now I think she's still got a lot of that NXT credit that's coming with her, but that NXT credit is a fraction of the audience that watches Monday Night Raw. There's a lot of people who don't know who she is from NXT because yeah. There's people who don't watch it. But that said, I did think that within this match, I thought they did a really good job of making it seem like it was a triple threat amongst three equals. You know, I felt like Rhea did not seem out of place in this match once the match got started.
Yeah, I can see that. And I think a lot of it has to do with how it was constructed, right? Again, I think having all three of them involved in more or less all of the physicality together really helped to paint that picture. I liked a lot of the spots that they did, you know, where I think there was one sequence where, you know, Charlotte would go for a boot and went, you know, going to Rhea, but somehow Asuka would get involved. And like, they just kind of did like this like circular triangle amongst the three of them and just kind of exchanging physicality. I thought it worked really well. And look, I hope that I'm wrong about Rhea. I hope that I can be proven wrong about Rhea Ripley, but you know, all right, after you've got a character in Asuka that has been absolutely destroyed by WWE. If it weren't for the fact that Asuka's so good, she'd be dead to rights in terms of credibility and equity in the character, because right now there is zero equity in that character. And, you know, Charlotte Flair, it's wild, right? Like, look, Charlotte, one of the absolute best, probably one of the best all-time performers active right now. But, you know, to speaking to like the shallowness of the roster, just again, by having it split across all the brands, Charlotte's a 14-time champion.
Yeah.
In what, 5 years?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah. It's a mistake.
It's a huge mistake, right? Because like, you know, look, again, you're butting her up to her father's legacy, but you know, it's not like Rick won 16 over the course of 5 years. Rick won 16 over the course of, you know, 30 some odd years.
Right.
You're putting her in an interesting position, but it just shows what do you do? Like, you know, are you using the title to build the people, or using the people to build the title?
Right.
And is it just a prop, or is it something that's meaningful, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? The arguments that have gone on, you know, since the dawn of time with wrestling, right? But to me, inevitably, all you're doing is, you know, unless you're going to put Becky on SmackDown, are you building Rhea Ripley up just to get beaten by Becky Lynch when she comes back?
Yes. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I couldn't picture Rhea Ripley beating Becky Lynch.
No, not at all. I mean, right, in terms of just star power and, you know, who really sits at the top of the mountain, it's Becky.
Isn't that wild that Becky Lynch has been gone for well over a year now and she's still the most famous woman on the roster?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, if I were her, I wouldn't step foot in a WWE ring until there's people back in the stands.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine the ovation if that's what happens. But I may have a bone to pick with you, depending on your take on this.
Let's hear it.
It felt to me, I was reading your tweets, as I tend to do. And it felt to me like you were defending the zombies tonight.
So I wasn't defending them. Not, I mean, look, at the end of the day, it was silly. It was all shit, right? But
absurd.
Like, yeah, it's absurd, but it wasn't the most egregious thing that I've seen on a wrestling show, Sam, especially with how bad Monday Night Raw is. It wasn't the most egregious thing I've seen on the show. Like, you know, there was an entertainment factor to it. And again, from being on the inside and understanding, right? Like, look, it's a business. And I imagine there was a decent amount of money thrown around to have that integration as part of a pay-per-view. I would imagine that Army of the Dead and their marketing budget threw a handsome sum at WWE to have that integration happen on the Peacock streaming network, which has a massive subscriber base. So while many folks would have thought the integration was silly, from my perspective as someone being on the inside, that's not the dumbest thing I've ever seen done. I mean, like, you know, I remember, I think Sonic was like a presenting sponsor of Monday Night Raw, and they had like a car hop come up with the roller skates with food for Michael Cole and King and everything. Yeah. You know, shit with like Hardee's hamburgers and, you know, all these other like just insane integrations, you know, like that are so ham-fisted into the show. But, you know, you got to do it because it's a business, and you've got bills to pay, and you've got people to pay. It's
funny that you say that, because I just saw a meme of CM Punk sitting at the commentary desk with Kentucky grilled chicken in front of him, a bucket of it.
Yes.
And yes. They go, yeah, it's not fried, it's grilled. And Punk looks at it, and you can tell he's about to say something, but he doesn't say a word. He just looks at the guys commentating with him and kind of shrugs like, okay, because he bites his tongue because he realizes, I'm not going to screw with the money here. I know what this is, and I am not going to. There's nothing. This is the moment where if I don't have anything nice to say, I'm not going to say anything at all.
Yeah, I'm going to listen to the old adage that my mother used to tell me. If I have nothing nice to say, just don't say anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's you know, look, you can't fuck with the money that's coming in. But again, I've seen far worse far worse that has made WWE TV for a lot less money. So this wasn't as terrible as some of the other shit that I've seen. It was still bad. But it wasn't without its entertainment value, like, because there was a port, you know, like I was sitting there watching it. I was watching it with my girlfriend and I was laughing with her. I looked at her, I was like, you know, it'd be even funnier because, you know, they still had the piped in crowd noise into the Thunderdome. I was like, they should have taken all the people out since you can't see them anyway. Just give me some like zombie and end of the world sort of like make this feel like I'm watching Resident Evil happen in wrestling.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that the zombies waited until after the bell had rung before, like they waited until the match was over before they ate the Miz. So that was very, good of them. Yeah,
look,
I just,
if you're gonna do it, you got to lean into it. You have to lean into it.
That I agree with. That I will agree with. But there's two things I think. Number one, for the sake of the way, like when I go, Raw would be so much better if it was 2 hours. And then somebody from within the business says, yeah, but you know what? They're paying a lot of money for the third hour, and this is a business. I go, okay, well, this is a wrestling podcast. It's not a business podcast. So I'm going to go back to my original point that Raw would be better if it was only 2 hours, you know? Like, I'm not here teaching business class. I'm here as a wrestling fan going, like, I was just watching a lumberjack match. You know, we do Patreon Zooms for the Not Sam Shills before pay-per-views. And somebody in there goes, hey, why is this a lumberjack match? And I go, oh, well, I'm assuming it's because, you know, Miz and Morrison have gotten involved in the matches leading up to this, all the interference. So they're going to stop the interference. And I would expect that Morrison is going to get involved and it'll lead to the breakup of Miz and Morrison. I would never have occurred to me to go, well, because, you know, they got to have a whole bunch of zombies at ringside. It's a zombie lumberjack match. And the other thing is, look, I've got to be honest here. If it were any other promotion besides my beloved WWE, you know how I feel about the World Wrestling Entertainment Organization, Mike Mansoor. You know, it's my lifeblood. I can't imagine the wildness that I would be talking about any other, if it was AEW, if it was Impact. I mean, the downright loathsome, scathing critique that I would have for any other pay-per-view that did something so stupid and juvenile as surrounding the ring with zombies for a lumberjack match. And then it happens on my beloved WWE. And the position that I'm left in is to say, well, they made a lot of money from a sponsor. You can, you know, I can't do that. It's not.
You can't do it. I'm going to do it for you.
Yes.
I'm going to do it for you.
Yes.
But think about it there, right? Like in terms of the entertainment value, right? Like a lumberjack match is usually just a bunch. It's like usually 20 guys standing around there with their dicks in their hands, waiting for their spots to come.
Yeah.
You had zombies. 20 had zombies. Zombies.
Although,
who doesn't love a good zombie?
Although I remember, I want to say, yeah, it was Rollins versus Ambrose in a lumberjack match. And it was one of my favorite lumberjack spots of all time. And I remember I saw it coming a mile away. I was like, Ambrose is going to jump over the lumberjacks. Over. And I go, because, you know, he's going to do one of those Ambrose jumps that he would do, just those wild dives, like the just wild, throw your entire body as far as you possibly can. I go, and he's going to do it over the lumberjacks. And I'm like, please let me see it happen. And I think it was a SummerSlam maybe. And he did it. And it was the coolest thing ever. It was like one of my favorite things. And, you know, I always kind of like the lumberjack matches. It lets a bunch of people who aren't on the pay-per-view get up there. I hate it when they make them wear the lumberjack shirt. This shirt right here. I hate it when they make them wear the lumberjack shirts. I like
Wait,
it.
I don't remember. Did anyone, did they really make people? I've seen a lot of wrestling, so there's some stuff that's been blacked out of my head.
Yeah, you should black this out, because I've definitely seen lumberjack matches where they made everybody dress up like Big Josh.
They were dressed. I took the words right in my mouth. They were dressed like Big Josh.
Yeah.
Damn you.
Yeah.
Damn
yeah.
you.
Yeah. No, I couldn't. I couldn't take it. I couldn't. I was sitting there going, like, a lot of people were saying, poor Miz, that he would have to go through this. But I go, no. Miz is Teflon. Miz is bulletproof. Miz is on that level. Miz can literally survive anything. I'm telling you right now, you could put him in the toilet for 3 years. If you get him and Maurice together, when Miz and Maurice are a package, they can be the top heel in wrestling in 2 weeks. No matter what has happened before, Miz will be fine. All I could think of is, this is not how Damian Priest gets over.
No.
This is not poor Damian Priest. I mean, this is like, it's literally his first singles main roster pay-per-view. Like everything before this was about Bad Bunny, and he was just there and it's like, okay,
second fiddle to Bad Bunny.
And now he's second fiddle to paid zombies.
Second fiddle to the zombies, man. Shout out to the zombies.
Although shout out to the zombies, because they did commit. Like you said, they leaned in. I thought Damian Priest did a good job of leaning in. Poor old Adnan Verk did a good job of leaning in when he gets on the call and he goes, we've gotten to a safer place. I was like, okay, good. Good. I'm glad you're safe.
Can we for a second here just take a minute to acknowledge how fucking good Corey Graves is, by the way.
Oh, Oh my God, Corey Graves. I don't think people realize how good Corey Graves is. I think Corey Graves, much like Michael Cole, those guys, it's going to take years of analysis to really pinpoint how good somebody like Corey Graves is.
Dude, now he's starting to add some play-by-play into his repertoire as well. He's really growing, man. He's really growing into the role. And on the counter, on the SmackDown side, I think Pat McAfee's been doing a hell of a job,
dude.
Really finding his footing and really finding his voice, and he's really coming into his own very, very quickly, which is not a surprise. I mean, you know, I used to always joke with him, like, dude, is there anything that you really can't do? And surprisingly enough, he pulls it off again, man. Like, I've been very, very impressed with how quickly he's taken to it, and not so much from what he's able to do as a performer, but, you know, from being there and actually getting a chance to be on headset, that's not the easiest environment in order to succeed. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, Vince being in your ear or anything like that. There's a lot going on than just what you're seeing on your monitors. And he's taken to it so quickly, man. But I imagine, just like, you know, he did with sport and everything else, like, you know, Pat's putting time in. I would imagine when he's not focused on wrestling or his daily show or his business or anything else, like, the brother's got his head full of what's going on in the streets. And I was blown away. I was totally impressed with what he did tonight on Backlash.
I thought he was, yeah, I especially noticed it in the main event. I thought he was absolutely tremendous. He did not feel like a new commentator whatsoever. And he did not feel like, you know, I mean, Pat's whole world is making it about Pat, not in a bad way. I mean, that it's what Pat does. He hosts the Pat McAfee show. Like, it's about kind of putting himself over as he describes what's going on. And that's what people like. That's what I like. Like, that's the gig. And even when he's on game day, you know, it's about creating moments. It's about jumping in the river. When he was doing the takeover pre-shows, it's like ending by jumping into the audience. Yeah, that's all stuff that's – and that's why he's there. Like, that's the gig. So this is a completely different gig where it's like your job is to make those guys look awesome and to tell their story in the best possible way. And, man, he did it. He did it, and he continues to do it. Yeah, I was pretty blown away by how natural he was already with Cole, and the fact that, like, he's not stepping on Cole. Like, there's a chemistry already there. It's remarkable. It's really great.
Yeah, they've developed a really good give and take very, very quickly, which, it's funny, right? Like, you would think that in a two-man booth it would be easier, but it really isn't easy because you really need that chemistry and that camaraderie there.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that he has been around Cole for so many years, they've kind of had that built-in relationship going in. And now you're seeing just an exaggerated version of that on air, and it's working. It's working really well. So shout out to both those guys, man, because they are fucking killing it, and they killed it tonight.
And if you notice, every week, because he's, you know, posting pictures and stuff, Pat McAfee has worn pants every show he's been on. So I feel like maybe Cole is cracking the whip a little bit, and McAfee's finally listening.
One of the greatest WrestleMania moments ever, and that all happened during rehearsals. A story for another time.
I think Pat McAfee just quit wrestling for the third time. All right, what's up now? Well, Mike Mansoury, it is always an honor and a distinct pleasure to have you on the show and to get some of your great insight. Is there any direction that you want to point people in to follow along with your with the happenings of Mike Mansoury?
Yeah, follow along with the shenanigans at Mr. MR_Mansoury, MANSURY. I wish I could spell my own name.
Yeah.
Just find out what's popping off there. Just kind of enjoying a little time here on the East Coast with the family. And I've got some projects coming up that are going to be launching relatively soon. So be on the lookout for those and information there. Other than that, I'll just be watching wrestling and just kind of shaking my fist like the cranky old guy, just getting the kids off his front lawn, man, because, man, I just want it to be good again. Yeah. I just really, really want it to be good again.
Look, just keep yelling at those clouds.
You kids.
Yelling at those clouds. Well, thank you, Mike. You're the man.
Hey, not as much of a man as you are.
Nah.
Sid Vicious said that once, I think.
Thanks for listening. Follow at Not Sam on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube.
Rate, review, and subscribe. This has been Not Sam Wrestling.